The Right to Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and by listeners like you.
What is a vagabond angel?
It's something I discovered on my first big road trip from Michigan out to mostly Colorado and also New Mexico and then up to California and down the coast. As I traveled, I would run across very random meetings with people who just seemed to appear out of nowhere, give you a little gift, whether it was a ride or a good conversation or a new idea, and just, you know, kind of serve as a beautiful little messenger from the universe. And I started thinking of them as vagabond angels. I don't know exactly how the phrase popped into my head, because we're talking like almost 30 years ago. But, you know, once I kind of identified the species, I started noticing them more and more, and they would quite often find a way into my poetry, and then now this book.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Mark Bodine about his book titled Vagabond Song.
When someone asks you what this book is about, what do you say?
I say something different every time somebody asks me.
I bet you do.
Yeah. And the more I've been traveling around doing some readings and having to think about it more in the sense of a finished product rather than being in the middle of writing it, I'm realizing that it has a lot to do with the idea of being feral, of kind of going back to the wilderness in certain ways, and wilderness both physical and psychic. I think that it's something that humans miss, and it's to our detriment, to the detriment of, you know, not only ourselves, but of the earth itself, to be disconnected from that wildness. And so traveling, especially what I call free travel, where you don't have a destination, you don't have, a credit card, you're either hitchhiking or finding rides from other sources. But you're just out there, and whether you're on the roads or in the wilderness, you know, in nature or not, you are connecting with the wild, the unknown, the randomness of the universe, where things actually just work out pretty well on their own.
So the part of us that doesn't have a plan for the day.
Yeah. You know, I have found that traveling is the best way to very quickly connect with this, of living in the moment, in that wild moment where you don't know what's going to happen next, but you just trust that it'll be the right thing. And so you don't try to force it. I find that for me, the best way to get in that mindset is to be on the road or in nature.
Without an itinerary, without a guide.
Exactly.
Right.
Each moment is this fresh experience. You never are going through the routine of your day. Every morning you wake up and you go outside, or you're already outside usually, but you get on the road or the trail, and every moment is this incredible gift of a surprise, of a new thing, a new poem. And the other thing is this idea of developing the distinction between a traveler and a tourist. For me, a traveler, you're connecting with where you are, your home, wherever you are. The traveler mindset, you're connecting with the place you're in, the community you're in, the people you're visiting or that you're part of, whereas a tourist has left home behind and is just visiting.
Well, let's focus on the book for a minute.
Sure.
Was the idea to weave poems into your narrative there at the start, or did it just develop over time?
Well, the initial idea was just poetry. I envisioned a mini chapbook that I would hand produce and have a stack of them in my backpack while I was traveling. So when somebody gave me a ride or one of these vagabond angels jumped into my life, I could thank them with a book of road poems. And of course, that never happened. It was on the back burner for a couple of decades. But I was thinking it was time to write a book. It had been a while. My last book of poetry came out, I want to say in 2006, but it could have been 2009 because that's how good I am with dates.
That's amazing. Yeah, you don't remember when your first book was published.
Right.
Okay.
But so, you know, it had been a while since I'd had a book. And I knew it was time to buckle down and do the next one other than just, you know, I write plays here and there or poems here and there, but the idea of a, you know, from beginning to end full-length book. So I was kicking around the different ideas that I've had and trying to see which one was the right one to write, and this is the one that wouldn't shut up. I couldn't ignore it. So I started going through all these old journals that I had, and I realized that it was more than the poems, that the poems hinted at stories without fully telling the story, and those stories I thought needed daylight. They'd always been only in my mind, in my memory, and the poems are, you know, little tiny, you know, river stones across a river. You can jump from rock to rock, but the stories are the river itself. So I wanted to have both.
Well, let's hear a passage from one of your hitchhiking adventures. It's from the top of page 31. Mm-hmm. But first, explain where you were and say who Shannon is.
Okay. So this was at a youth hostel in Colorado, Grand Lake, Colorado, right at the edge of Rocky Mountain National Park. And I had hitchhiked up from Winter Park, and I was there for a few days, and I'd meeting some of the other hostelers, some of the other travelers. Shannon is a character that's loosely based on a woman who was staying at the hostel. You know, some of these stories, they are 25 years old. And so, I have no idea what her name was. I think she was from England, you know. But you've kind of pieced together a story from the scraps of memories that I have, and hopefully it works. So if anyone out there thinks they might be Shannon, I probably owe you a free book. So, anyway, so this is after a day we spent out on the lake. We rented a boat where this crazy, crazy guy almost killed us out on the lake, driving the boat like a maniac in a big thunderstorm. And then I ended with all us back at the hostel having some drinks and having dinner. A parenthesis moon rises over the mountains, bleeding through torn rags of cloud. An unseen owl calls out, reminding every small creature of its beautiful mortality. Shannon takes the last drink, giving a crystal glisten to her lips. I want to kiss her, and I think she wants me to, but shyness and the hush of the moon prevails. We head off to our separate rooms, but before turning down the hall, she looks back. So if you want, you could come find me in Denver, she says. We'll be staying at a hostel there for a while. 2 days later, I'm back on the road, heading to the birthplace of Thomas Hornsby Farrell, who wrote Corn Grew Where the Corn Was Spilled, in the wreck where Casey Jones was killed. Two short rides bring me back to the main road. Walking the shoulder heading south, I watch the daily storm clouds climb over the peaks to darken the sky. My first vagabond angel appears, slicing through the rain in a rusted gray pickup. She veers to the side of the road and swings open the passenger door, holding tightly to the collar of an excited German shepherd. Where are you headed? Denver. I'm going right through. Hop in. Vagabond angel appearing as the rain starts, sudden red flower. In that moment, I didn't know that Mary Jo in that rusted old pickup was a vagabond angel, or that there were such creatures. But since those days in Colorado, there have been many road trips and many encounters with these demigods from the pantheon of my personal mythology. They are usually nomadic, but sometimes only psychically so. They are familiar strangers living poems, loping through fields, highways, and smoky bars as if part of the landscape, dancing graffiti leaping off the crumbling bricks of every town I pass. Since Mary Jo, there have been many others who have stepped in and out of the scene, who briefly became part of the story, who with a single note changed the melody of my travels. But she was the first I recognized, my first recorded vagabond angel, though I don't remember her real name, the actual color of her truck, or even what kind of dog she had. We slow to match the pace of an overloaded logging truck in front of us. The rain fades, replaced by the spray off the multiple tires of the logger, keeping the wipers just as busy. Her dog settles between us, his big head resting in my lap. Mary Jo lowers the radio and says, "So are you headed to Rainbow then?" "To what?" I ask. "The Rainbow Gathering. I hear it's happening out here somewhere." "Never heard of it," I say. "What is it?" "Some big hippie thing. I just figured you were going there. I mean, hitchhiking, long hair." "I don't know," I say. "Maybe I am going. I just don't know it yet." "Maybe. So what are you doing?" There's that question again. People are always asking it. What are you doing? Where are you going? What's your destination, your goal, your purpose? It's usually asked with a tone of accusation, but not this time. Mary Jo is different. Her tone is wide open without a hint of judgment, as if the question means, "Tell me about your soul," rather than, "Explain your plans for your bank account." "I guess I'm just traveling, seeing where the road takes me." Mary Jo smiles. She likes that answer. "Ah, good," she says, "a temporary nomad." I let her phrase roll around my tongue. "A temporary nomad, yeah, that fits fine." We bounce down the mountains like a Woody Guthrie ballad and slip into the dirge of Denver-bound traffic on the interstate. All three of us go quiet and edgy. The soulless red lines of interstates are no place for travelers, no place for vagabond angels, road dogs, or poets. These corridors were originally designed to move the army and still have a militant, regimented feel to them. They are intended to be used only for transporting rolling steel coffins from one monetized moment to another. Having an authentic experience here is highly suspect.
So at that point, what did an authentic experience mean to you?
Wow, you ask good questions. That's why you have this job. I think, you know, and I don't want to keep harping on it, but this idea of living in the moment where the experience, it's not about the commercialization of anything. Like I said, one monetized moment to another. Most of our lives, especially in a country like America, with the economic system we have, there's a lot of pressure to only do what's connected to money in some way, whether you're shopping, you're buying, you're consuming media, you're consuming television, you're consuming something. It's the fact that we're often referred to as consumers rather than humans. And I think because of that, it's easy to start forgetting that we are human animals. You know, we are animals. We are part of the natural world. And to remind ourselves of that, I think, is to live in authenticity.
We're always expected to be so productive.
Yes.
Even as consumers, we're expected to produce and then use that money to go out and consume.
Exactly.
But you're talking about an experience where you go somewhere, you don't know exactly what's going to happen, and so you're interacting face-to-face with a tree or a person with no agenda. I think that's what you're writing
exactly
about.
Exactly. Yeah, and I like that phrase, without an agenda, because most of the time we're supposed to have an agenda in our dealings with other people, in our dealings with the world at large. And this book, you know, in a sense, it's basically the record of a guy who was just loafing for 15 years.
And seeing what happened.
Yeah, and realizing that's where true experience, true beauty, true connection and community, they happen when we're not trying to get anything out of someone else or a situation. We're just allowing it to happen.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Mark Bodine about his travel memoir, Vagabond Song. This program is available at our blog and as a podcast. You'll find links to both at mtpr.org/twq. Links to our Facebook and Twitter pages are also there. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about the eternal now and find out what happened after an angry ex-con picked Mark up in Northern California. Don't go away.
Was a phrase you used that I liked. I think it was eternal now.
Mm-hmm.
That being on the road was a great way to experience the eternal now.
Exactly. For me, it's a very Taoist way of living. And some people can get in that state where they're living in the eternal now or the moment through meditation or through fasting or through studying, whatever practice, yoga, anything. And I've dabbled in some of those, but the two that work the best for me, one is traveling, being on the road, free travel. And the other is theater. I do a lot of theater, and I find that all these concepts are the same. To really be present on stage, to be in the moment, results in very authentic, powerful theater. To try to have an agenda of thinking, oh, okay, this next moment I get really angry. So, okay, let's see, how do I get angry? Oh, I make this face. To me, that type of theater is dead and deadly. Whereas just being in the moment, trusting, in that case, you're trusting the play, you're trusting your fellow actors, and just knowing that if you jump, the stage is there. Mm-hmm. and it'll work. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter, because now you're in a new moment. And it was a past moment where it didn't work, and that doesn't exist anymore because you're in the moment.
I mean, I know this is your experience, but there have to be people who said to you, including your friends and family, you're not safe there. What are you doing? As you read in that passage, what's your plan? What's your goal?
Yeah.
And you sort of had a goal to write some of this down, but not everybody can just go out on the road and feel okay about that. So what do you think it is about you that makes it okay for you to do that?
I'm foolish. Just a fool. I was very, before my first road trip, I don't know how old I was, 20, maybe 21. And I was very nervous about it. I thought, oh God, I'm just going to be out there alone, and it's not like I'm in the position that if things go wrong, I can just jump on an airplane and come home. I was worried about people. To me, that's about the only scary thing in the world. It's humans. They're very unpredictable and dangerous. But a few days before leaving, I got mugged in my hometown, in the parking lot that I parked in 3 or 4 days a week to go to the bar that I went to, maybe not 3 or 4 days a week. That sounds terrible. But doing what I used to do all the time in a place surrounded by people who know me, surrounded by, everything that makes you comfortable and not afraid. I was with one of my best friends 20 feet away inside the bar were 20 or 30 good friends, and I got mugged, with a rifle, oddly enough. I remember thinking how weird it was that he didn't have a handgun. He had a rifle. And he mugged me, and he took, the $3.18 I had in my pocket. But I just thought, well, hey, if that can happen here, why are you afraid of the unknown? Clearly, if something bad is going to happen, it could happen anywhere. And that made me not worry so much about going on the road.
But the unknown is so scary.
Yeah, which, is part of why it's so wonderful. I think embracing the unknown as well as embracing things that we might be uncomfortable with or afraid of, is what takes us to the next level as our own kind of personal evolution. We don't become more interesting people by staying home and watching television.
But we become more interesting sometimes by reading books.
That's true. Hopefully. Otherwise, what am I doing writing them?
Here's a quote that I really liked. A free ride comes with an obligation to entertain with a story or to receive one. So what kinds of stories did you hear from people when you got into their vehicles?
Oh, every kind. I remember one guy who picked me up in Northern California, and this is in the book, but he picked me up and he was really aggressive, just had this like angry energy, and was driving way too fast and was, you know, like covered in tattoos. This was before I had any tattoos. And I think he had like no shirt on and, you know, just kind of energy. And he said, you know, sorry, I'm driving so fast, but and you know, I'm really angry. I'm like, all right. And he said, yeah, I just got out of jail and found out that my girlfriend dumped me and my best friend committed suicide. And how do you respond? So we were silent for a few moments and I thought I might die today. But I think him just speaking those words, something changed. He slowed down, he relaxed, he apologized. And we continued driving and he was actually a really sweet guy who was just going through a really bad time. And so I just let him talk and he talked about his life and kind of how messed up it was, but he wasn't lashing out with it anymore. He was just telling me about it. You get picked up by a lot of people who used to hitchhike. And by picking you up, they can relive those days a little bit. And so they tell you about their hitchhiking stories. A lot of times it's, you know, guys coming back from the military who hitchhiked around for a while. And, you know, so you're in a car for a period of time with a total stranger, and it's the type of stranger that you normally would never have a conversation with. At the time, I'm this 20-something, you know, freak, and I'm in a car with a 70-year-old, very conservative man who, you know, his life story is as different from mine as you can imagine. But because you're just in this situation together, you end up connecting and talking and, you know, hearing a story of a life that I couldn't even fathom, which was always a huge part of the enjoyment for me.
Former hitchhikers picking up other hitchhikers leads me into another passage. And this one's near the end of the book, and it involves a truck named Clyde and a person named Clyde.
Exactly. Yeah, this is me arriving in Montana for the first time. And I don't know if it's confusing that the truck is named Clyde because I got picked up twice earlier in the book by a guy who I call Clyde. I've always called him Clyde. That's not his real name. Anyway, after Bear Butte, I head northwest, clip a corner of Wyoming, and eventually hit Montana. A few miles after getting back on 212, I pass a hitchhiker. I'm not sure why, but I don't stop. This is totally out of character for me. Clyde, my truck's namesake, has his 5 rules to live by, one of which is always pick up hitchhikers. I follow this and the other rules whenever I can. With his characteristic mirth, Clyde had told me his 5 rules. Number 1 is always talk to strangers. If you don't, you'll never have any friends. Number 2 is always pick up hitchhikers. Lucky for you. Number 3 is always give anyone anything they ask for. Everything I have is a gift, so it's meant to be passed on. And number 4 is always allow anyone to do you a favor. If you deny someone else the chance to be generous, you're preventing them from improving their soul, and you're keeping the world one more step away from heaven. What about rule number 5, I asked. Number 5, he laughed, is always be on the lookout for rule number 5. Seems like a pretty good code of ethics to me, ever since I've done my best to live by them, especially after the countless rides and acts of kindness strangers and angels have given me. I usually go out of my way to get hitchhikers to where they're going. But this time I just drive by. I feel guilty right away, begin to worry about the karmic repercussions, but still I don't turn back. Maybe I don't want the spell Bear Butte has cast to be broken, but more likely It's that too much time of not being on the road, breathing the concrete and smog, suspicion and isolation of the city has made me cold. Whatever it is, I drive on into the thickening dread of my bad karma. Just after the Montana border, I enter the town of Alzada on the Little Missouri River. Their one gas station is trying to gouge people for $3.39 a gallon. Every place I've seen on this trip, no matter how small or remote, had prices hovering around $3, mostly below. I have a little under a quarter tank left, and my map shows two other towns on the way that are near enough, so I mentally flip them off and drive on. When I find that the next two towns have no gas stations, and I'm now well under one-eighth of a tank, I sense just how old man karma is going to kick my ass. As the miles unroll through the harsh barrenness, I slow down and roll up the windows in a nearly useless effort to conserve gas. When the next town turns out to be nothing but a crossroads with a long closed store and a couple of barns, I know I'm in trouble. As my needle dips below E, I start wondering if one of the very sporadic ranches I pass would have any gas I could buy. But I realize if they did, it would only be diesel. I'm looking at a long, very hot walk on an empty road to find gas and a long, very hot walk back. This also means finding a place to crash for the night, as it will then be too late to make it to my cousin Doug's place outside of Livingston. Finally, with the engine sputtering in near defeat, I begin a thankful descent into the town of Broadus and coast on fumes into a gas station. And even though I'd gladly pay anything, they're only charging $3.13. I fill up my tank and begin to breathe again. The next hitchhiker I see is going to get a ride right to his front door. I'll even carry him across the threshold and tuck him into bed. With the stress of an empty tank gone, the drive is beautiful again. Rising through the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow reservations, the latter home of the Little Bighorn. The last time I came this way, I stopped so I could dance on the spot where Custer died for his sins. But there was an entrance fee, so I turned back. A few years later, I would go to the monument, but it was all just too tragic and stupid and pathetic to dance. I stared at the markers for a while, then left with nothing to say. Eventually, I drop onto the interstate at Billings. In a quick 2 hours, I'm entering Livingston, home of Michael Earl Craig, who wrote, "It's a poet's job to be dragged by an ankle through town." I make a stop to grab a bottle of wine for Doug and a six-pack of PBR for me, then head south into Paradise Valley, where on the east side of the Yellowstone River, tucked in the shadow of the Absaroka Mountains, is the Grizz Fork, my cousin Doug Peacock's place, and a small writing cabin that will be my home for the next month. Clyde crawls up the gravel road and swings onto a spot in the tall grass between an aluminum canoe and an upside-down John boat. I jump from the cab, calling out the words of Whitman to the surrounding mountains and willows, "Bearded, sunburnt, gray-necked, forbidding, I have arrived."
Mark Bodine eventually settled in Livingston, Montana. Look for more information about him at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. Also there, you'll find poems and book reviews and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Michael Marsalek, executive producer, Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.